killers, murderers, decoding the crime verse.
911, what's your emergency?
Hello, and welcome back to Decoding the Crimeverse. I am Danny, and I'm joined with...
Noreen.
That's correct. And today we have another serial killer, and this is an unsolved one. They've never actually managed to discover what really happened. It's in Finland. We've never done a murder in Finland before. So please excuse, because the names are like the most crazy Scandinavian names in the world. I've been to Norway and Sweden, and yeah, the Scandinavian languages are very interesting to try read. So if I mispronounce, I apologize in advance. But we are looking at the lake. How did you say the lake's name?
The lake bottomers.
You see, I can't even say the lake's name, so it's going to be a little bit hopeless for me today.
It's almost okay. it's like saying bottom with an American bottom. Pronunciation.
Wow.
So the lake bottom murders.
Anyway, before we get into it, I actually have a question. I want your opinion on this. So there was a bit of a scandal going around the internet, and people are claiming it as stealing, and I want to know what you think. So do you know the artist JoJo Siwa? No, probably not.
No.
She's kind of like, she was on Dance Moms. She made kids' music for quite a while, but she's recently gotten out of her Nickelodeon contract, and now she's making like other music. Anyway, she released this new song called Karma. And she claimed that she had written the song for 2 years, and she's going through this whole rebrand to be like she's no longer a kids artist and things like that, and took her really long, and she's really proud of it and whatever. To find out that the song was written and recorded by another artist in 2012.
Okay, this is sounding interesting.
And that artist's name is Britt Smith, and she also she wrote the song Karma, and she had made a music video, but she had never published it because they were originally going to sell the song to Miley Cyrus.
Okay.
But Miley Cyrus didn't want it, so she just kind of kept the song. Anyway, now JoJo took the song, made it. Now, obviously, if she had written it and published it, JoJo would have had to have bought rights.
Yeah.
Obviously, so that's technically not stealing. But I want to know from you, is then when asked about this artist, she denied knowing who she was or that the song was written by her?
That's a classic move. They always deny knowing the artist.
No, but here's the funny part. So then the original artist released the song as well, and it outranked JoJo's version on the charts. Some people are saying it was really Karma that came after it. No, I'm kidding.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, for me, I mean, she did buy. She would have had to have bought the rights, because otherwise she would have had a big lawsuit coming away. But I do believe credit is due. And so to completely deny knowing who Britt Smith is and claiming credit for writing the song, I don't believe that is right.
Yeah, I don't believe any of it is right at all. So I mean, you stole the song, you stole the song.
Yeah. And then in her quote, she literally says, there's no such thing as stealing.
Exactly.
Wait, can I show you a picture of her? I think you might actually just have a bit of a laugh. I don't like her. She gives me stress. This was her before the rebrand.
Yeah.
And this is her after the rebrand. That's what she wears in the Karma music video. I don't particularly like the song. It uses the Ten Commandments in quite a not so Christian way. So I'm not exactly the biggest fan of the song.
So and basically it's just another artist making fun of Christians.
That doesn't make it right that she stole the song. And the music video is a bit sketchy.
Yeah.
No, it's not a bit sketchy. It's very... very sketchy. I'll show you after the show, but that's enough about JoJo and her little scandal. I just thought it was very funny that the other Britt Smith's version surpassed her on the charts. I was like, well, that's what you get. what goes around comes around, I suppose. So anyway, we are speaking about the Lake Bottom murders. Okay, and again, like I said, these names are wild. So the Nils William Gustafsson. Okay, that's his name. It's already, it's a lot, guys. I'm trying. Had a really bad night, but he didn't remember it. It happened on June 4th, 1960, so quite a while ago, when Gustafsson was 18 at the time, and he went camping in Espoo, Finland, with his friends. And his friends were Seppo Antero Boisman, Boisman's girlfriend Anya Tuliki Maki, and Gustafsson's girlfriend Malia Ermeli Boishklant. That is as far, I'm not going to repeat those names, so get them in your head. They all set up a tent by Lake Bottom and spent the evening chatting and drinking. Later, they went to sleep in the tent. Guys, I don't understand people who want to actually sleep in tents, who willingly go and sleep in a tent.
Yeah.
On the hard ground, where there is bugs and rocks and snow. I like my... You know, the one camp, I went on school camp, grade 8. We got there, and the first night, they're like, you're sleeping outside. So they tricked us like 5 kilometers into the middle of the wild and made us sleep on literal gravel with just a sleeping bag and a pillow.
Nice.
No, excuse me. Do you want That's to do that?
That's what camp is supposed to be about.
No, do you want to do that?
Yes.
Okay, go sleep there on the road tonight. We'll see how you wake up.
Camp, no, road,
the worst, two different things. The worst part was the next night we did the same thing, but at 3 a.m. it started raining. So we had to trek back at 3 a.m. back to the camp and get to the dorms soaking wet.
It's part of the adventure.
Did you go on any school camps? No. So how can
How do you know that I didn't go on any school
camps? Did you go on any school camps?
Maybe.
What school camp did you go on?
I wouldn't remember.
That you didn't go on any school camps.
What do you mean?
Because they're traumatic. You would have remembered.
Okay. If you say so.
No, I know so. Anyway, the next morning, two boys were out bird watching and they saw the tent from afar. They couldn't see much detail, but they noticed the tent was torn and slashed. They also saw a man with blonde hair walking away from the campsite. The boys kept walking, not paying much attention. However, later that morning, a local person walked by the tent and found a shocking scene. Gustafsson and Boisklund were lying outside the tent covered in blood and bruises, right? Inside was Boisman and Maki, and they were dead, with knife wounds and injuries indicating they were attacked. Boisland, Boisman, and Maki were all dead, but Gustafsson survived with just barely. When questioned by the police about what happened, Gustafsson could only say that it was a mysterious figure dressed in black with bright red eyes. Sounding a little bit like a horror movie.
Yeah.
Although, they had said he'd been drinking. So maybe a killer coming after you with a knife, you're going to hallucinate just a little bit, you know. Although, if I also had someone coming at me with a knife, I would also think it's some demon person coming at me. So I probably also would have been like,
yeah,
crazy man. Anyway, months and years passed, but the police couldn't get any more information from Gustafsson. The Lake Bottom murders became widely known in Finland, with people talking about how the killer was still at large, and parents warned their children not to go out after dark, fearing the killer might still be around. In March 2004, however, now this is like, what, 44 years later, a breakthrough occurred on the case. After nearly 50 years, DNA evidence led prosecutors to a suspect they believed had a motive for the murders. This development was supported by forensic science that had not been available to the investigators in 1960. Surprisingly, the suspect was Nils Gustafsson himself. And he was now a suspect in the murders. When the police had arrived at the crime scene, Gustafsson was in a severe condition, suffering from a broken jaw, bruises, and a concussion. He could only recall his story of encountering the supernatural figure in a memory clouded by shock. Okay. So, if it was him, he would have had to beat himself up. How do you break your own jaw? Like, I understand making yourself falling and getting a concussion, but, like, breaking your own jaw?
I'm trying to make sense of it.
I don't know. It's a bit weird. So, back in 1960, now, they did have other suspects. So, we're going to go through those other suspects before we get back to Gustafsson. But investigators relied on physical evidence to reconstruct the events of June 4th. The group had arrived at the lake campsite on motorcycles, a popular spot for camping and fishing near Helsinki. Although, not Helsinki, Helsinki. I just realized I actually know the name of that place. Although the bikes were found at the scene, the keys were missing. And Gustafsson's shoes were also discovered half a mile from the campsite. However, no murder weapon was ever recovered. Now, I don't know why his shoes were not in the tent. I don't know why you would take your shoes off while you're in the middle of nature, because you never know what can come and eat your feet. I'm just
eat your feet.
Sorry, next thing you sleep in there, there's something wriggling between your toes.
Wow,
no,
definitely.
Thank you. I'll be sleeping with shoes on.
Definitely.
I can't, because I'm not an outdoors person at all. The most intriguing aspect was the manner in which the assailant carried out the attack. It appeared that the teenagers had been stabbed and beaten while inside the tent as the killer slashed through the fabric to reach there. That must be so scary. You're in the tent, next thing, quack, 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 well, here's this man with a knife outside. Stab, stab, stab. No. Gustafsson was discovered on top of the tent, and according to the same accounts, so was Boyslund. This suggested that she either crawled out or the body was moved after the attack before the arrival of the police. The scene itself had been baffling, even under normal circumstances. However, investigators made their task more difficult by failing to fully secure the area and allowing search parties to comb for evidence. This resulted in a disturbance of the crime scene, making it difficult to assess footprints and other potential clues. So obviously the police made a mistake here.
Yeah.
With limited physical evidence available, the prospects of resolving the case seemed grim. No arrests were made, and only a few suspects were identified in the years to follow, like we've been saying. So one of the person of interest was Carl Vladimir Gilstrom, who operated the kiosk business at the campgrounds and was known for having a violent temperament. Carl reportedly had frequent confrontations with campers, often due to noise disturbances. There were allegations that he would sabotage tents out of spite and even throw rocks at visitors he was particularly angry with. So not a nice man.
Yeah.
However, what people believed was that he had snapped and then viciously attacked the Gustafsson group. And this theory gained momentum when Gilstrom died by suicide in 1969, supposedly having drunkenly confessed to the murders just before. However, the police declared Gilstrom could not have committed the crime because his wife provided an alibi that he was in bed the night of the attack, and the confession was false. Now, no one knows why someone would just confess soma soma, but maybe in his drunken state, maybe with his... Also, having people speak about you can really play with your mind. So maybe hearing all those rumors and having people laugh at him and being like, oh, this is the guy, could have really played on his mind, especially if he wasn't like mentally stable, which he wouldn't have been mentally stable if he killed himself. So... police had other leads too. There was Paulie Luma, who had been said to have been in the vicinity of the campsite. However, he had an alibi for that night being in another town. There was also Pentti Soininen, who was a thief who confessed to the murders while being in jail for other charges. However, the police really just believed this was jailhouse bragging rights. He just wanted more credit inside prison.
Yeah.
So no one, it seemed, could be placed at the scene, and no one other than the man who had managed to come out alive. For decades, the lake bottom mystery sat unsolved. Meanwhile, DNA testing was growing into a viable way to re-examine both current and cold cases, first being used in the 1980s. However, Finland only had one forensics lab, and they didn't have the capacity to look at old investigations. But it was revisited in 2004, like we said earlier, and this is when we had a fresh look at Gustafsson's shoes. And they became a focal point of the new round of accusations.
Yeah.
Forensic scientists at the country's National Bureau of Investigation Crime Lab conducted tests on the shoes and discovered traces of blood from the victims. Interestingly, there was no blood from Gustafsson himself on the shoes. This raised puzzling questions about how he could have been involved in the attack but only had the victim's DNA on his shoes. Authorities speculated that Gustafsson might have carried out the attacks himself, then disposed of his shoes before inflicting injuries on himself to create the impression of external assault. Okay, my guy, you were right by a lake. Why didn't you throw the shoes in the water? Do you get me? Like, why leave the shoes to be found? That's pretty dumb. Like, it would have sunk to the bottom. Guys, people can be stupid sometimes. I'm just saying.
You really think his shoes would have sunk to the bottom?
Shoes sink.
Okay.
Do you think all the shoes were just floating when the Titanic sank?
Yeah.
Don't be stupid. One time my brother rode through a lake and his shoe came off and we had to get in the lake to find the shoe because floating. It was so disgusting, but anyway. Investigators proposed that Gustafsson may have been driven to murder the three victims due to feelings of jealousy. The witness, who was camping nearby on the night of the murders, testified in court that she witnessed a heated argument between Gustafsson and Boysman, with Gustafsson being heavily intoxicated. Investigators speculated that perhaps Boysland had rejected Gustafsson's advances, or Gustafsson believed Boysman was making advances toward her. This could explain why Boysland appeared to have sustained more stab wounds and blows than the others. The police theorized that Gustafsson was forced out of the tent, possibly following a physical altercation with Boysman that resulted in a fractured jaw. According to this theory, Gustafsson then returned in a fit of rage, wielding a knife, and attacked his friends until they were dead. The district prosecutor in Espoo decided to press charges against Gustafsson, potentially facing a life sentence if convicted. Gustafsson's lawyer, Rita Leppäniemi, defended his innocence, pointing out that Gustafsson's blood had been found inside the tent and argued that being severely beaten to the extent of a broken jaw by Boysman would have rendered him incapable of committing such a violent act against three people. I don't know if I agree with it. When you're filled with rage, you're filled with rage.
Yeah.
You get some supernatural strength over there.
It's called adrenaline.
That one. Yeah. You get that adrenaline. So I don't know if he really... And yes, there might have been blood. If you're breaking someone's jaw, there's going to be blood somewhere.
Yeah.
So, I mean, of course there would have been blood inside the tent. Okay. The lawyer also criticized the credibility of the eyewitness testimony from the camper, who remained silent about the alleged fight she had witnessed for 45 years without explanation and had difficulty recalling important details. During the 2005 trial, police officer Markku Toiminen testified that Gustafsson had been surprisingly candid after his arrest, remarking, "What's done is done," and predicting a 15-year sentence for the crime. However, Gustafsson maintained his innocence and retained the same account he had provided for decades, insisting he could only recall going fishing with Boysman and denied any altercation. The court ultimately concluded that there was insignificant evidence to convict Gustafsson, noting that too much time had passed to accurately reconstruct the events that night. Consequently, Gustafsson was acquitted and released.
Yeah.
Nearly six decades later, the mystery surrounding Lake Bodmin murders remains unsolved, firmly entrenched in Finnish folklore. The incident even inspired a heavy metal band to adopt the name Children of Bodmin, and the band releasing a beer made from water sourced from the lake. Wow, guys. Wow. Some individuals in Finland have speculated that Gustafsson's claim of not remembering anything could have been seen as inadvertent admission of guilt. However, such speculative reasoning falls outside the domain of the courtroom. Another perplexing aspect is why Gustafsson's shoes were discovered so far away from the campsite. If he had removed them before sleeping, one would have expected to be placed closer to the tent. Additionally, who was the blonde man spotted by the boys walking away from the area, which was later revealed to be the crime scene? Furthermore, if Gustafsson had indeed orchestrated and staged an attack on himself, why was there no blood trail leading to wherever the knife was disposed or concealed? These lingering questions continue to add layers of complexity to the Lake Bodmin mystery. The Lake Bodmin murders remain surrounded in mystery with only one certainty. Someone managed to kill three individuals at the shore of Lake Bodmin. Whether the perpetrator was a single individual or a group, or even something with glowing red eyes, the truth behind the gruesome murders have eluded authorities for decades. I don't know how I feel. On one case, I kind of see it being him, like getting into an altercation,
yeah,
then coming back with rage. I like get that, and then trying to make yourself like you're part of the attack. But then things don't add up. Yes, why did that witness stay silent for 45 years? If she had seen something, why didn't she speak out? I mean, that's something you like, you should speak out against.
Yeah.
Especially with a case that became so famous. Do you get what I'm saying?
Actually.
And secondly, where's this blonde-haired man? Because those two boys saw the blonde-haired man.
Mm-hmm.
Where did he go? What was he doing? So, I don't know. Then there's the shoes. Why are the shoes moved? It's very confusing.
Yeah.
Bad. I don't know what to say. It's made my brain sore.
Bad cover-up.
I don't know. Part of me wants to believe it was Gustafsson. Part of me doesn't want to believe it's Gustafsson. I'm perplexed.
Yeah, but what about the DNA evidence?
But there was his blood inside the tent.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
So, either the blood could have come from his fight, or it could have come from being stabbed by some maniac. Like, explained both ways. My thing is the shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Why are the shoes there? And why would you get rid of the knife correctly, but not the shoes? That's another thing. If you knew the shoes were a problem, actually, why would you have had to get rid of the shoes? Because if you were lying in the tent with all the bodies, surely blood would have splattered on your shoes. So there would have been no reason.
He was on the run and his shoes were left behind.
But then he came back and beat himself up and got back in the tent until he was discovered. Does that make any sense?
He beat himself up.
Well, that's if he was the one who killed the rest. So do you see that if he had killed the people, there was no reason to take his shoes off, especially if he was gonna go back and lie in the tent beaten up, because their blood would have automatically got on his shoes, so it's not like it would have been suspicious.
Well, he had a fight, right?
Yeah. No, but I'm saying, okay, let's say he wanted to make it look like someone else attacked them, and he got blood on the shoes while killing them. He didn't need to remove the shoes, because if an attacker did attack the group, blood would have got on his shoes anyway. So there was no need for the shoes to have been left. And why... was the murder weapon not found, but the shoes found? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, how could he have hidden something so well and something not so well? Like, it doesn't... So I maybe think there was this blonde man. Maybe he took the shoes. Maybe he was homeless and wanted shoes. I don't know. And then was like, oh no, there's blood on them. Let me leave them. Who knows? I don't know.
Yeah, this reminds me so much of the show you once did where guys did a money heist and got caught. The only difference with this one is that he actually didn't get caught. So, yeah.
Yeah, guys. I feel like it's the blonde man, the mysterious blonde man. Although I don't know why people were seeing red eyes. That's a bit sketchy. But That is it for the Lake Bottom murders. A very intriguing case. The thing is, I get annoyed with unsolved cases because sometimes they never get solved. And then I'm going to live the rest of my life not knowing the answer.
Yeah.
And that makes me irritated. But excited at the same time because I'm like, what happened?
That's just how life goes.
I know. But that is it for this week. We hope you enjoyed. From now until next week, we will see you next time.
Active FM. Radio has never been better.